Check, 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 check. Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers number 42 at the Chameleon Field. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/41. These include links to the papers discussed in this podcast, related episodes, and other things that we discuss in this episode. Okay, well, hey, Randy, what's going on?
Jim, it's good to hear your voice.
You didn't think that you were going to hear my voice.
Well, we had a little technical trouble there before, and you sounded like you were at the bottom of a tunnel in the Marianas Trench somewhere.
You know, it's funny you should mention that, Randy. No, it's not really funny. I'm not really at the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Good. A lot of pressure down there.
It's a lot of pressure doing this podcast, Randy. I know you didn't read the 34-page paper, but I did. Oof. And, I mean, it was worth every minute. So I don't know which papers you read, so could you tell me what two papers did you read for today?
Well, I read The Chameleon Fields, Awaiting Surprises for Tests of Gravity in Space by Justin Corey and Amanda Weltman. That was the Physics Review Letters in 2004. Then I skipped over the 30-something page one, which was Detecting Dark Energy in Orbit, The Cosmological Chameleon, by a whole slew of authors. But Corey and Weltman were in that group. And then Chameleon Field Theories by Justin Corey in Classical and Quantum Gravity from 2013.
So I'm getting a trend here. So there's something going on here with chameleons. What's going on with chameleons? What is a chameleon?
Chameleon fields. This is a new type of scalar field that I guess Justin Corey and Amanda Weltman came up with as a possible explanation for dark energy. And the neat thing about chameleon fields is that this scalar field changes its mass in the presence of material bodies, so it kind of blends in. It becomes undetectable in situations where you're like close to the Earth, for example. That would explain why you can't detect the field in Earth-based experiments, or even in solar system experiments, and why we can detect the dark energy field in between galaxy clusters. So they were looking for a way to model like a scalar field that would mimic dark energy, and this is what they came up with.
Okay, and I know you don't like doing this, but
what?
At least at the very beginning of the second paper of the Chameleon Field Theories, they talk a little bit about the three viable screening mechanisms for general relativity. And I think that's probably a good place to start, is at least to mention them, and then we don't have to mention the other two at all. So one is this chameleon field, which is a scalar field that couples to matter that is basically proportionate to the amount of matter that's available, right? Mm-hmm. And because of that, it produces light particles in the void, and it acts like a fifth force, but near matter, it has a short range. And we'll talk all about that later on. Mm-hmm. The second one was the Weinstein mechanism, which is a scalar field where the derivatives couple to matter sources. And that one seems to be essential to the viability of massive gravities. And so we'll probably end up talking about that in the far future at some point when we want to talk about massive gravity.
Okay.
Massive gravity is just where you have a graviton that weighs something that has a mass. And then there's a symmetron mechanism, and that is where the vacuum expectation of the scalar field is inversely proportional to the density. So that's a little bit different. That's a little bit quantum mechanical. So those are the three different kinds of screening mechanisms. We just want to look at this chameleon field, which is a little closer to a relativistic description of what's going on, whereas these other ones seem to be a little more quantum mechanical.
Is it like a quintessence then? Is that what we're talking about?
The chameleon fields act like or are a kind of quintessence. What do you understand about quintessence?
Well, I thought that quintessence was just an idea where instead of having a cosmological constant, which is uniform throughout all volumes of space everywhere, that quintessence was more of a mechanistic thing, where you had some kind of energy that was a real energy and that it had more of a interaction with matter and it would distribute it differently. It wasn't linearly distributed.
I do remember from one of these that it was sort of a kind of quintessence. So the quintessence is a scalar field that's sort of rolling along a flat potential. And it's sort of massless on solar system scales, and it has an unnaturally small coupling to matter. So I think basically it's fair to say that the chameleons are a kind of quintessence, although there might be some differences. So definitely in a couple of these papers, they were drawing distinctions between this and the standard sort of quintessence model.
Yeah, because this is a very unique mechanism that I'd never even heard of before until we looked at this. I think it came up in a previous episode. We were talking about different models for dark energy, and that's why we decided that we want to look a little closer at it. I mean, they're describing this as a mechanism for like a fifth force of gravitational strength.
They're saying that in the void where the particles are light, then they have a very long wavelength. And that means in the Yukawa potential, which has an exponential as well as a 1 over R term, these things can actually mediate some sort of coupling between objects and act like a fifth force, at least in the matter frame, in the Jordan frame. So yeah, I mean, it ends up giving you a fifth force. And they go through a lot of detail to show that with the current constraints on a fifth force, the chameleon field is okay. Although there are a lot of constraints on them if you look at that second paper, the chameleon field theories.
The one in 2013 also gets into, like, I think explicitly talking about how the constraints allow the model to exist within a certain parameter range. This is like as a fifth force, we're talking about some kind of like a gravitationally repulsive force, right?
Yes, this has to act somewhat repulsively, right, in order to make something dark energy. Well, I guess it doesn't. So what it's saying is that, you know, this thing's acting in the Einstein frame, but in the Jordan frame, you end up getting stronger effects. Okay, now I'm confused. So I would have thought to model the dark energy would have to have a weaker effect, right?
Right. Yeah, and there's a negative sign in front of equations in the first paper. If you look at equations 6 and 7, it looks like it's a negative scalar field, so that indicated to me that it's some kind of repulsive field, right?
That's definitely what they're saying, is that this has to have some sort of negative energy. There has to be some sort of negative energy somewhere in here. You're basically stuck with it. You need a negative mass.
It's a little confusing, though, because when I'm looking in here at equation 16, the end of that first paper, it's showing like the Newtonian equation for gravity, and then there's this extra term, and it's multiplied times 1 plus 2 times beta 1 and beta 2.
And beta 1 and beta 2 are the couplings between different kinds of matter and gravity.
So that's a little confusing, because that would seem to indicate that if the beta terms are positive, that you'd be looking at a greater force.
Well, it says that the C experiment, do you remember what C stands for?
Yeah, I did have that somewhere. I had to look that up, and it was really tricky, because when you put SEE, which is the acronym, with pretty much any other term, it brings up all the stuff that you don't want to see. It's the Satellite Energy Exchange Project.
Yeah, we have that problem with Physics Frontiers itself, right? It's not really a Googleable name, right?
Oh, crap. Really?
Well, if Physics Frontiers podcast, thankfully, is. But Physics Frontiers, you've never typed it into Google?
I guess I have, but it's been a while. And it occurred to me that I didn't think we would be ranking very high in the first place, so... But I think there was a magazine or a journal or something by that name.
Yeah, there's a journal, a series of books. There's an award from the National Science Foundation or a group of awards from the National Science Foundation or something like that. And, you know, just anywhere where they say physics and frontiers together, which how often could people say that? Right?
Yeah.
Apparently quite often.
It's not as bad as this is like the C satellite, though, because when you type that in, you're like, how to find satellites when you're looking in the sky?
That's true. So C is pretty bad for an acronym if you want people to actually find your work.
I like the Dark Energy Survey, because DES, you know, that doesn't come up too much, you know. But all these projects they talked about, there was another one called the STEP Project.
Yeah. People just weren't thinking marketing when they made it. Well, they were thinking marketing. They were thinking how to market this to get the grant, right?
Right.
But then nobody can ever see their results.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyways, they were looking at the C experiments, and they're saying you get an effective gravitational constant that's a little bit larger than, actually, much larger.
Yeah, like double.
well, yeah, these couplings are supposed to be on the order of unity. They're supposed to be around 1. And so that means if you have 1 plus 2 times beta 1 times beta 2, that's about 3 times as large as normal gravity. Now, somewhere over here, I saw another number where it was only about twice as large, but that was in another paper. If I just look at this, it's about 3 times as large. That looks a little bit odd.
It does, because what if the dynamics would be totally different, right?
Yeah, it does sound like you'd have something different there. But, I mean, there's a little bit of a strange idea here, right, which is that you're doing the calculations again in this Einstein frame, which is where the Lagrangian is paramount. Then you're doing all your observations in the Jordan frame, which is the matter frame. So that means that you have to be very careful about what you're talking about. So you say, okay, my observation is seeing something that looks like there's a greater force. Does that mean that I actually have a smaller force if I look at this other frame? Or does it mean I actually have a larger force? Or what actually is going on? And I'm not really sure how to make sense of that. Although, I mean, that makes a lot of sense when you're talking about modified gravity, right? To have a distinction like that.
Yeah, I don't understand how to work out the two metrics, you know? Like, I guess there's a complicated relationship between them.
Well, I mean, it wasn't too complicated. The relationship was you have a transformation and you just square the transformation and you go from one metric tensor to the other metric tensor.
Oh, is that what that A term was in there?
Yeah, that was the conformal factor that switches you between the frames. The Jordan frame is just A squared times the Einstein frame. And to get your acceleration, right, you just add the natural log of that A to the Newtonian potential and take the gradient. Okay, so are there any things that you thought were really interesting about this?
Well, I kind of love the fact that it's more of a phenomenological look at dark energy. But one of the things that I found perplexing was they calculated the Compton wavelength of this chameleon force carrier particle at 1 megaparsec, roughly, in empty space where the density is super, super low. So I guess when you've got lower energies, lower mass particles, then you've got a much larger wavelength. That all adds up. But if there's a limited range of 1 megaparsec, can that really model the behavior that we're seeing with dark energy?
Apparently they believe it can. Now, the question is where do you see the behavior, right? So we're saying we can't see any difference at our local level. But then if you go to a level within that megaparsec range, you can see the difference, which is an effective, stronger coupling to everything. So if you're looking within that megaparsec range, where one thing is close to a bunch of other things, and you're estimating the masses, you're going to estimate masses to be too large. And then when you look at things that are even farther away, and try to use the masses from the stuff within that 1 megaparsec range, they're going to act like there's less coupling between them, like there's some sort of dark energy pushing them apart.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, I like the fact that it makes sense with the cosmological evolution because in the first few billion years, the universe was denser, and so the chameleon field probably would have been suppressed, right?
Yes. Okay, so you didn't read the one where they talk about stuff like that for a long, long time. In the paper that you didn't read, I think, they spent a lot of time talking about overshoot and undershoot, or did they do that in the paper you did read?
They didn't mention any of that in the second paper I read.
In that detecting dark energy in orbit, they spend a lot of time talking about overshoot and undershoot of that potential. Apparently, what happens is that before the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, it's allowed to do more or less whatever it wants. It can be more or less or anything, but by the time it gets to the Big Bang nucleosynthesis, that scalar field, that chameleon field, that thing should be at more or less its minimum value. And it has to more or less stay at that minimum value from Big Bang nucleosynthesis to the present day. And there are several difficulties with that, because if the field is too high early on, it's basically overdamped, and it doesn't want to move down to that minimum. But as the universe cools, each time a particle becomes non-relativistic, the top quark becomes non-relativistic, the electron becomes non-relativistic, and all the other particles, Z bosons and all those things, each time one becomes non-relativistic, that basically pushes the scalar field towards the minimum. And so it gets pushed towards the minimum by the particles becoming non-relativistic. And so it should be at that minimum at the Big Bang nucleosynthesis.
Okay.
And if it's too low, it's doing a lot of oscillations. If it's underdamped, it's doing a lot of oscillations beforehand. But as, you know, the temperature cools, it gets more and more damping. And so it should also approach that minimum. So they've got excuses for why, they've got reasons why they think this thing is going to get to the minimum at the Big Bang nucleosynthesis and then just follow its minimum, you know, forever after, or maybe not forever after, but for some time thereafter, which includes this time.
Well, that sounds like it might jibe with the work that Adam Riess was doing. I don't know, I guess when that was in the 20-teens or maybe even a little earlier, they were looking for the dark energy effect going back further and further into cosmic history. And they said that they were able to detect its presence, you know, even before the cosmological acceleration started to speed up like 6 billion years ago. If they look back as far as something like 9 billion years, they could still detect its influence, but it wasn't sufficiently strong to throw the galaxy clusters apart at an accelerating rate like we're seeing now. That would kind of fit if it's been at that minimum for a long time. Did that paper talk about the prospects of this mechanism explaining, like, inflation? Because that's another expanding acceleration that seems to remain unexplained.
It talked about inflation. It talked about the big bounce. Or did the third one talk about the big bounce?
There was no mention of the big bounce in the third one. Or inflation.
Okay, it talked about the big bounce as well. So, yeah, it did talk about inflation and stuff like that in that third paper that you didn't read.
What was their verdict on that? Did they think that it could explain inflation?
Well, they thought that the chameleon field would behave just sort of like a dust during inflation, and that inflation would help push phi to zero, okay? Which means that the overshoot or the overdamped solution that I was talking about has a second reason to get to its minimum. Had a weird thing that it was talking about where inflation is going to decay into radiation matter plus a chameleon kinetic energy. So it's actually saying that the inflaton decays to radiation matter and chameleon kinetic energy. That sort of means that the inflaton decays into three things instead of just two. But again, the radiation domination will push this into overshoot and have some issue with that. And then they talked about how it worked with the cyclic universe as well, and it said it works with the cyclic universe just as well as it does with inflation. That in that case, it actually works a little bit better than other quintessence models.
It's hard to imagine a big bounce scenario, though, because at this point, doesn't it look like the dark energy is, it's accelerating things at an increasing rate, right?
Yeah, but that's in our sort of measuring frame, not in the frame with the energy. Right. So that makes it a little bit hard to interpret, right? So the important thing that I wanted to say was what they were saying is that if you have a self-acceleration, what's going to happen is that your observed cosmic acceleration comes from the assumption of the minimum matter coupling. There's no actual dark energy. What's really happening is you have a real modified gravity. So if you have a self-acceleration, you don't have a problem with that because, you know, it's only apparent in the Jordan frame what's happening. The Einstein frame that's defined by the action, that's not doing that. So it's possible that that wouldn't be true. But I think chameleons don't have the self-acceleration. So that means that they do have a problem with that. They do need the dark energy. But you still have that same issue. Right. You could still have in the Jordan frame something happening that isn't happening in the Einstein frame.
That's confusing. I don't think I'm really understanding the difference there. I haven't seen the Jordan frame and the Einstein frame both used in a context like this before. Can you clarify that at all?
I can't clarify it very much. I'm happy to see this again and to get a better idea about what they actually are. Because at least in these Corey papers, it seems like he has a really good idea about what they are. In the previous papers where we've had to deal with it, I wasn't really sure what either of them were, no matter what words the people sent at me. But in this particular case, I do have a feeling for it that Jordan frame is more or less the matter frame and the Einstein frame is the energy frame. Okay. So our measurements basically take place in that Jordan frame, and the Einstein frame is more or less the place where the math works.
Huh. Okay. So you can see a self-acceleration in the Jordan frame, but in the Einstein frame, it doesn't show up.
Well, yeah, if you see an acceleration in the Jordan frame, but not the Einstein frame, that is a self-acceleration, and in that case, you have a modified gravity. But that there also implies that you could have different effects going on in those two situations. So you can have that acceleration in one state and it not be quite so drastic in the other state.
I like the fact that this just sort of opens the argument for why we need these really high precision, low gravity experiments to be conducted in orbit. It's interesting that in order to find out what's going on with dark energy and with gravity, it seems like we need to probe these really weak regimes of gravity, right? Like, it seems like we're going to find the answer there. Whereas, you know, with like particle physics, you're always looking at higher and higher energies to try to understand the more underlying physics. But with gravity, it seems like we need to see what's going on in the really, really weak gravity regimes.
Oh, yeah, very, very weak, right? So this has got to be much more sensitive than, say, the Cavendish experiment. Yeah, I mean, there was something about, you know, trying to do this with interferometry. I don't know exactly where that went.
They did an experiment in the lab, which I thought was super cool. They did an experiment to test this chameleon field theory in the lab, where they had, you know, a reasonably small spherical vacuum chamber, and they had like an aluminum sphere that was like an inch in diameter in the middle of that, and then they released some cesium atoms into the vacuum, and then they used a series of laser pulses in order to... somehow where they were able to create an interference pattern. So it was some kind of atomic interferometry. And by studying the interference pattern, they could detect whether the cesium atoms were falling in accord with gravity or if they were falling in accord with gravity plus a chameleon field. And they weren't able to detect the chameleon field in the lab. So it ruled out certain energy ranges, like a really wide swath of potential chameleon field solutions, but they feel like they need to conduct this experiment in space to get something like 10,000 times or better precision, because the drop time is going to be so much smaller and high at a high altitude that they'll be able to see any differences a lot more precisely.
So yeah, I mean, anytime you can get somebody to go do your experiment in space is a good thing, right?
But apparently that kind of like atomic interferometry experiment can be used for all kinds of different physical fundamental tests. And so this is just one of the many reasons why they should put one of those things in orbit. But I don't think that any of these satellite experiments with gravity have happened, have they?
Not that I know of, but I'm not the source for that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I haven't run across anything. I haven't seen any references. I don't think that the SEE project went ahead, because I haven't seen any results online about that. Although there was, I think, mention in maybe it was a 2013 paper or another paper where they were saying that there's even more reason now to conduct that kind of experiment than there was when it was first proposed in the early, like 2000, 2002, something like that. So yeah, I don't think that any of these really important satellite experiments, I mean, the last one that I'm aware of was the Gravity Probe B. That was kind of, the data was kind of a mess, but it did confirm to within 10%, I think, the gravitomagnetic effect. But especially now with dark energy, it seems like now would be a really good time to do those kinds of experiments. I was pretty amazed that they were able to do a dark energy test. I think that this experiment to test chameleon fields was like the first like lab experiment to see if we could find the mechanism for dark energy. And so that's really exciting that there's still ways that we can probe the fundamental, you know, physics of something like dark energy in the lab. I'd love to see more of that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Very clever physics with that. They do these things in Washington. Do a lot of these.
In Washington State University?
I think that's where the Atvos Wash experiments are, right?
I don't know. I didn't look that up.
You don't know. Okay. And I don't even know how to pronounce it. And hopefully it doesn't make me use the umlauts in Google.
I don't think it does.
Okay, so, yeah, I mean, there was an old experiment called the Ottvoss experiment.
But don't those go way back?
Yes, but so those are torsion experiments, and, you know, they've been around since 1880 or something like that. You know, these were just experiments to get better and better ideas about what G was early on. But they've been doing them recently in Washington, and they've been doing them to look at tests of general relativity, tests of variant theories, and they've just been getting them more and more and more precise over a long period of time using, you know, modern technology. And they do quite a good job of it up in Washington.
I think they just bumped out, like, I can't remember who it was, Purdue or somebody. They're now in the top 10 universities in the country.
Top 10 universities for what?
I think just in general, like in the top 10 universities in America for, I don't know, across the whole spectrum, I guess.
Congratulations, Washington. Okay, Washington State or the University of Washington?
I don't know.
Probably the University of Washington.
Okay. The one in Seattle, or are they both?
Washington State is on the eastern side of the state. We were talking about something relevant before we talked for 15 minutes about U.S. News and World Report and email addresses. So, what were we talking about?
Well, I don't remember what we were talking about, but one thing that I wanted to mention was that they seem to have gotten the energy of the density of dark energy basically correct. Like, you remember that? Like, they calculated the energy for these scalar particles, and it came into like a 0.00 something or other electron volt range, which is like in the right ballpark for the dark energy effect. That was pretty awesome to see that.
Yeah, so works out pretty well. I mean, they're, what, 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, which is about, what, 10 times the Planck mass? Or 1/10 of the Planck mass, one of the two. And that is about where we see their dark energy from. So, yeah, I mean, it works out really well. I think they've mentioned that a couple of times in the stuff I looked at. I think there are a lot of interesting things that they do talk about in here. I'm not sure about all of them, but they do talk a lot about different things that are supposed to be happening as far as this is concerned. I really like this prediction, right? They say, you know, if the chameleons interact with the electromagnetic field, then there should be a photon chameleon oscillation that I think they said somebody was trying to test, but they didn't say anybody found it, so I assume they didn't find it. Quantum chameleons, was that in your paper?
I think they did talk about quantum corrections.
They were talking about the quantum corrections, but I think that just really says that the quantum corrections that happen when you get heavier and heavier chameleon particles give you some issues, right, with these quantum corrections, and you have to add in more and more terms, and that just leads to some sort of instability. And so you get an upper constraint on that thing, and you've got a problem with the fifth force if the chameleons aren't strong enough. Because if they're not strong enough, then you have them not only interacting, I guess, within galaxies, but between galaxies, and then they don't explain the dark matter, so now you don't need them anymore. You have that sort of issue. Is there anything else that you really found interesting in these papers?
Let me take a look. No, I think that pretty much covers it. I'm looking through my notes and I'm not seeing anything else that I've highlighted in bold that we haven't already touched on. Oh, there was one thing that I wanted to ask you about. They talked at some length about this thin shell when you're looking at like a spherical distribution of matter, that I guess all of the chameleon particles would be completely suppressed within the bulk. But I think there's like a thin shell right around the surface that's like a millimeter thick or something, where I guess because of the wavelength of the chameleon particle, right, like at the surface of the Earth, would create like a really thin envelope. But I guess because it's only like a millimeter thick, you won't be able to detect it in the lab, you know? Because, I mean, our experiments with gravity are nowhere near sensitive enough to detect, you know, the influence of a millimeter thick shell of force around the surface, you know, that'd be gravitational in nature, you know.
And I think you also have another issue, right, which is the atmosphere. Because the atmosphere itself has non-zero density. So it's not like you have a shell between zero and the chameleon field. It's maybe you have a bit of a bump between the chameleon field for the more dense matter and the chameleon field for the less dense matter. That sounds to me like it might be really difficult to find or really difficult to measure. Now, maybe they can think of a way, but I mean, I haven't seen the actual numbers, right? So it would also depend on how big it was, but I don't think they even mention a experiment to go along with that. So if they're not mentioning an experiment, they don't know how to detect it either. Because again, you know, they're doing everything right here, right? They've got entire papers on how to detect this stuff. I didn't get a chance to go back and look at that again and worry about it too much. So
it does seem like we need these space-based experiments and we need them right away, you know?
Okay, so I'm going to email your friend Donald.
Oh my God.
And tell him that you need these experiments right away.
They need to be the greatest. They need to be the best experiments in space ever.
Exactly. This is America. That's what we do. So I'm sure if you put it to Don like that, they'll go for it. All right?
That's right.
It'd
be the biggest.
So this is your time.
Well, thanks for going over the chameleon fields with all of us here, Jim. It's a lot of fun to, you know, I know it annoys you when I liken science to like a very specialized form of abstract art, you know, where your parameters are set by our observational data. But this is just a great example of how science can be an amazing form of conceptual art, because they looked at the problem, you know, of, wait, you know, dark energy, what's that all about? And then they thought, well, how could there be an explanation for this in like a scalar field model, which we know exists now because of the Higgs boson and that the Higgs field. And they said, okay, what kind of properties would it need to have in order to hide from all of our current experiments and observations and yet still produce this long-range effect? And this is what they came up with. And it's pretty brilliant, very clever. It's very creative, even.
It's very creative. That's where these guys live. I mean, this Justin Corey.
And Amanda Weltman.
I don't know what Amanda Weltman is doing, but Justin Corey is doing this, you know, superfluid gravity or some other strange thing right now.
Holy moly.
You know, he didn't stop with one idea. He's got a million of them.
Good. He's got a million of them. Let me tell you about the next one. Yeah, we'll have to read some more of his papers. I want to see what he's up to, because this is good stuff.
All right. Okay, Randy. Well, thank you very much for talking.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your clarity.
And I'll talk to you next time.
All right. Be well, buddy.
Okay, bye now.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers number 42, The Chameleon Field. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/41. These include links to the papers we discussed on this podcast, related episodes, and other things that we might have discussed as well. If you'd like to help us out, you can go to www.patreon.com/physicsfrontiers and become a patron there. I think we have enough people to meet our immediate goals, which is basically to just pay for the podcast. But, I mean, if you'd like to help out a little more, maybe we can do something a little more in the future.